Music to accompany the royal fireworks that celebrated the signing of the peace treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle in the late 1740s. Handel's overture to his orchestral suite was played there by the English concert directed by Trevor Pinnock. And plenty more from Handel at the BBC Proms this week, as I say. Glyndebourne Festival Opera will be in residence from 7 o'clock on Thursday night and live here on Radio 3 with their new production of Rinaldo. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, and we're going to stay at the Proms now. It's 10 o'clock, and here's Tom Service to introduce tonight's composer portrait.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall in the Royal College of Music for this Proms Plus portrait, featuring the music and the person of the Irish composer who was born and brought up in South Africa, Kevin Volans. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music are going to play three of Kevin's pieces, the 10th String Quartet, a work called A Thousand Bars, which is both a trio and a quartet. I promise that'll make sense later. We start, though, with a piece whose sheer power and volume speaks for itself, Asanga for solo percussion. Now, Asanga is a Sanskrit word that means freedom from attachment, and Kevin Volans wrote the piece in 1997. So here, please welcome now on stage at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music, to play with considerable freedom, no doubt, Kevin Volans' Asanga, percussionist Barnaby Archer.
Thank you.
Barnaby Archer playing Kevin Volan's Sanga here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Kevin Volan's, you said, I said that piece spoke for itself, and it does, and the sheer energy and power, especially of Barnaby's performance, but you say in a rather gnomic programme note about it that you wrote that piece without any concept or technique in mind. But, I mean, you must have had something, surely, with the sheer focus and ferocity of what we've just heard. That surely isn't... Surely you had an idea that that's what you wanted to do with this.
No, I never have an idea of what I'm going to do. I've spent the last 30 years trying to work on a sort of anti-conceptual method of composition where you just start and let the logic of the piece dictate... Each bar dictates the next one, and so on. So it's really just contrasting different kinds of patterning. I did have in mind the fact it's called a Sanga, Freedom from Attachment. I wrote it for my friend, Robin Shulkovsky, who had lost her father. And she and I believe very much in the sort of healing power of drums and drumming. And I thought if I wrote her a difficult piece and she spent hours practicing, it would help. And she said it did, so that was the idea.
But Kevin, the sense of starting literally then from a blank piece of manuscript paper, but a blank idea in that way, I mean, where does that come from? Because it goes against a lot of the people you trained with. I'm thinking particularly of Karlheinz Stockhausen, whose assistant you were in the 1970s. This idea of not planning seems to go against what he was all about.
I know the whole school of serialism was based on pre-planning, rather like architecture. I studied architecture as well, and I loved the idea of planning a large piece, like planning a skyscraper, with down to the last detail before you start building. But it didn't work for me at all as a method. And also, I mean, I was very influenced in the 70s. By African textiles that have an unpredictability about them that can't really be pre-planned. And I also then made a series of recording trips of African music and found myself teaching, on one hand, serial technique to the Stockhausen class and being in love with this completely different world. And African music is generally... it's not non-conceptual, but it is kind of anti-conceptual. And I think the right word is existential. So I wanted to find a kind of existential way of composing that you are in the moment and you start with the first bar and you stay in the moment and let the piece grow out of that rather than planning in advance.
There's quite a dichotomy there, though, isn't there? I mean, it's one of the things, even you asked to be introduced as an Irish composer who was born in South Africa, but in a way that difference between an African perspective and a European perspective, I think it seems from reading your biography, going to work with Stockhausen in the 1970s and then writing those famous string quartets, or what became string quartets, White Man Sleeps or Hunting Gathering, that in a way you had to be in Europe to discover you were African, whereas when you talk about playing the piano growing up in South Africa, you thought of yourself as European.
Oh, no, absolutely. That whole thing of you growing up in Africa and thinking of yourself as... We were called Europeans, you know. I mean, that was the official name. You know,
as a white South African, you were called
Europeans only. It was only later became whites only. I mean, it's so bizarre. And as soon as I got to Germany, I realized I was not European. And then I went back to South Africa and thought, I'm not African either. So you certainly by the late 70s, I had a kind of identity crisis from that point of view. But then by the mid 80s, having worked through that, you realize that your identity lies in the work, really, in your own composition in a way. I mean, you don't need a nationality, as it were.
No, okay, but you probably need, I mean, you need models or you need inspirations from somewhere. I think you've said somewhere that you can escape your cultural upbringing, but you can't escape your environment, what's around you. So what were the things that you took from the environments, whether you're thinking about walking along the street in South Africa or in Cologne or wherever, that became part of your music?
Well, the huge difference, I mean, between Cologne and South Africa is space and time, not just space, but time as well. Everything in the 70s in Germany was compartmentalized into little pieces of time. You could go to this office from 10 to 12 in the morning or 1 to 3 on Wednesday afternoons and so on. And I was so used to living in a sort of an infinite environment where not only space, but time feels infinite.
In Africa, you mean?
In Africa. So I felt when I did the first pieces, which were soundscape pieces of the African bushveld and insects, and so which is the...
These were literal field recordings of the sounds.
I made live recordings, yeah, and made a big piece which we presented at the ICA in 1981. And I felt we evolved as a species in that sound environment, which has not changed for millions of years. And I felt that the sense of space and tranquility that those sounds carry with them, and a sense of time, which in the West we have completely lost.
But then you've got a problem, you see, because if you're writing pieces, I mean, whether you like it or not, you're writing string quartets, you're writing orchestral pieces or chamber works, even the percussion piece we just heard, which does, after all, have a time, lasted about 8 minutes or so. It's being programmed here. We're not, alas, this is a very nice space, but it's not infinite, this concert hall. So, I mean, aren't you already working with a sort of contradiction there about actually having to write? I mean, your pieces of music inevitably are compartments of time, like German offices.
You're very politely avoiding the word compromise. It is, of course, I started by writing open-ended pieces, which have no given duration, and you can play it for as long as you like. But the whole West, I mean, the minute you walk on stage and present any kind of music on stage, it becomes concert music. Even if you take traditional African music and put it on stage. And there's an expectation, because everyone's sitting there in rows, I mean, they've got to go home. They want to get out.
I
mean, they're trapped, so to speak. So there are limits, time limits. But I mean, I'm still fighting against, because every new commission, particularly if it's an orchestral one, you say, "Oh, goody, can I write 45 minutes?" And they say, "No, no, between 20 and 30, preferably 25, because that can be easily programmed."
Now, look, the next piece we're going to hear leads on very precisely from what you're just saying, because after all, it's called 1,000 bars. I mean, what could be more about measuring spaces or times of music? 1,000 bars of music, presumably. Is that what happens?
It is 1,000 bars, but it's a very tiny... There's only one event per bar. I very rarely write short pieces like this, 8 minutes. But when you get the opportunity, they're very good as opportunities to experiment a bit, so to speak, and they become etudes of composition. And the 1,000 bars, in a way, goes back to long conversations I had with Morton Feldman about getting over the bar line. And I decided to put one event per bar, just one note or one chord, so that their idea of you can't get across the bar line, so to speak, so it's a kind of an intro. And it's relentless. A sort of succession of 1,000 events.
And each bar is very short. It's only one fast crotchet.
It's only one note, yeah.
In each bar. So there's a sort of obsessive quality to this music. It's also completely different from a sangha. It's also very quiet.
Oh, it's the opposite. It's almost inaudible, yeah. But well, we chose these pieces for contrast. Because it's a small piece, you can do things like that, and that's what becomes interesting for the composer. Mm. So they're pieces about composition rather than about concerts, if you see what I mean.
Okay, well, what you wanted to say to the people in the hall and the people listening then, if this is a piece that only composers can understand?
No.
That's like something
I think
the Germans would say
in
the 1970s.
It's a way for people to get into the world of composition.
Very beautifully put. Nicely avoided, too. Let's hear, then, Kevin Volans' 1,000 Bars. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, Francesca Barrett on violin, the cellist Romain Deno, and the two pianists on one piano, Matthew Fletcher and Gregory Dorrit. 1,000 Bars. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Volland's 1,000 Bars, exactly 1,000 Bars. I hope you were counting at home, just as we were here. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, Francesca Barrett, Roman Dino, Matthew Fletcher, and Gregory Drott. Kevin, I'm getting the impression you like musical extremes. The reason I say that, of course, is based on what the difference between the two pieces we've just heard. Very fast, very violent music, obsessive, small, machine-like, quiet music.
Yeah, well, they're the two most extremes that I've written. But I like music that takes risks. And it's one of the things that I was so pleased with the commission for the Liszt bicentenary was that Liszt was a composer...
Your piano concerto.
The piano concerto from this evening. That Liszt was a composer who was not afraid of taking risks and not afraid of making big mistakes as well. And for me, he was the father of modernism, the first composer to experiment with if you define modernism as nothing is given and you look at things a priori without any preconception, he's the first composer I know of who worked with synthetic scales, with whole tone scales, with atonality, with 12-tone rows. I mean, he was really... in a sense, ahead of the game. And he's a composer who later on wrote pieces that were about composition. In big contrast to somebody like Brahms, who always produced great work but destroyed anything that might not, all his early work, so that, you know, nobody could think that he had any flaws.
All right, so you're an heir to Liszt then?
Oh, yeah, no, I love, yes.
But does that mean, all right, well, what mistakes have you made then? If you say Liszt made a lot of mistakes and also let them out there, what mistakes have you made?
I'm not going to mention them in public. Big one. But I mean, this is a risky thing to do, really.
1,000 Bars, that piece.
1,000 Bars, and very quiet, and there is a very well-considered sort of development in the piece, but... it may not be apparent, and it's also so quiet that you might not have heard that they were not playing the same thing all the way through. and also the reason for two pianists is because of the extreme difficulty of playing that softly. I divided the piano part between two people to make it more playable.
All right, but where then does the intuition then come in your music? I mean, because if you think about Liszt as a model of somebody who's looking for extremes, who's unafraid of going places that music hadn't gone before, your music on the surface at least doesn't sound like Liszt. So are there composers or people you go to, you think of, who in more recent times maybe have got that intuition thing right?
I think intuition is the wrong word, and I think we should also be clear that these are aspirations rather than things I've achieved. They're things I would like to achieve. I mean, there is no such thing as a conceptual composition, and there's no such thing as a sangha, freedom from attachment. If you reach that stage, you are enlightened and you really don't have to bother about writing another piece. There is a kind of a private dialogue that goes on with composers all the time, and I think somebody like Liszt makes that clear. I mean, I very strongly believe that music is not upmarket entertainment, classical music. I mean, it's a philosophy, and it's a growing philosophy and a growing kind of conversation that goes on between composers, and it's as much about composition as it is about coming up with a final product that people are going to listen to, if you know what I mean. There's two sides to it, a private and a public side, and with these more experimental pieces you are revealing more the private side, so to speak. It's difficult with a big public event to take the same degree of risks. I could have done this with the piano concerto and had the piano just going bloop, bloop, bloop for 20 minutes while the orchestra played inaudibly, but I don't think I would have been invited back. So it's a balance, it's a compromise between you choose to what you think is appropriate for the moment. I mean, so with chamber music, with a short piece, you can be wilder than you would ever be in a very public kind of event.
Now, fittingly, the last piece we're going to hear tonight, Kevin Volans' 10th string quartet, in a way puts the two extremes of the worlds we've heard in the first two pieces this evening together, with this fast, violent music and still music as well in the 10th string quartet, Kevin.
Yes, it's mainly fast and violent here. I have to say that it is, at the moment, it is the 10th string quartet. It was two movements. The second movement was a disaster. So it's now only one movement, but I'm sure it will be two movements at a later date. I am the bane of my publishers' lives because I keep rewriting pieces and they keep changing names and lengths and everything. But at the moment, this is the 10th quartet.
Again, in your very short program, there is a personal, there seems a very deeply personal inspiration to behind this piece.
Well, there was, in that not so much an inspiration, but I was busy with the first movement and got almost to the end, and my brother died. And then the second movement was a disaster, and it was simply because I was all over the place. So that's why I had to scrap it in the end, you know. But again, this is part to do with every decade I've tried a different, I mean, I've tried to overcome notions about form, firstly notions of style, then notions of form, then notions of what is composition. And in the 2000s, I decided to get rid of the notion of content. So I wrote some very empty pieces, but the opposite. This is the opposite. One way of getting rid of content is put so much material into the piece that you can't hear anything clearly.
Okay,
so it becomes a barrage of sound.
Right,
and
so
this was
a very
my
dense piece,
experiment
then, yeah.
In that direction. Yeah.
Where is that philosophy going to take you in the future?
I have no idea.
Really, none?
None at all, really.
Where do you hope it will take? I mean, do you hope that you will get to that state of pure Asanga-like enlightenment? I mean, is that actually what you're striving for as a composer?
I think that would be great, yes, but I would definitely give up at that point. But I have to say this is not just frivolous in the sense that there are good reasons for it. And I felt that so much music of the 20th century has become a victim of its own concepts. And that included Stockhausen himself, who was such a master of combining imagination with concept and with technique to begin with. But later on, he became a victim of his own technique and his own craftsmanship. So this is all an attempt to go beyond craftsmanship, because I think a new art lies in that realm beyond your own knowledge. And therefore, you can't use what you already know, so you have to explore unknown areas.
As we're going to hear now, in the 10th string quartet, music full of content and yet empty and yet full. The Artesian String Quartet, musicians from the Royal Academy of Music playing Kevin Volans' 10th string quartet.
Thank you.
The Artesian String Quartet from the Royal Academy of Music. Kate Southers, Emily Davis, violins, viola player Matthew McGuire, and cellist Alexander Rolton playing. Kevin Volans String Quartet No. 10, bringing to a close tonight's Proms Plus portrait on the music of Kevin Volans. Thanks to all of the performers from the Royal Academy of Music who've played here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music, to you all for being here, and of course, to Kevin Volans himself. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, in that Proms composer portrait, Kevin Volans was in conversation with Tom Service. This is BBC Radio 3, broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM and also on digital radio. Well, now it's just coming up to 10:45 and it's time for the first of this week's essays. Now, you may well have listened to the prom concert this evening, but did you listen correctly and did you know there were rules? Well, the music historian Richard Witts of Edge Hill University charts the rise and fall now of the music appreciation movement.
How do you listen to music? Would you say A? By the way, I'm not really asking you. I'm reading from a music appreciation pamphlet of the 1920s. A, with your ears. B, through your ears. C, with your brain. D, with your mind. E, with fastidious attention of all the faculties. The answer is apparently E. But in order to achieve this fastidious attention, you need to make use of A to D, the pamphlet tells us, smoothly evading any mind-brain dualism along the way. The rather pushy tone of this pamphlet is typical of a central phase of the music appreciation movement, which grew out of self-help manuals in the 1890s and fizzled out on the radio around the 1970s. During that time, it keenly attached itself to the latest technologies, the pianola, the gramophone record, the radio, cinema and television. In that sense, it proved to be an opening stage in the construction of the modern consumer, with its emphasis on the latest gadgets of oral reproduction. At its interwar peak, the movement had almost become a craze, along with twanging the ukulele, miniature golf, or waking up with Emil Coué's cry, "Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better." Music appreciation articulated that very notion, how people evolved into better and ever better moral beings by listening with fastidious attention of all the faculties to classical music. They had this moral trek to undertake because the movement was aimed at the working class, who, after all, in the eyes of their betters, had a long way to go, getting better. This movement started out in the United States at the close of the 19th century. It did so as a splinter off the cross of Christian evangelism. Pastimes such as singing in choirs and playing in temperance bands have been promoted as physically healthy and morally fulfilling, as they had in Britain. These recreations were said to keep the growing class of urban workers away from gambling and drink, but music appreciation was freakish in its emphasis on listening rather than doing. In this, it was inspired by literary appreciation, where the silent reader and the verbal writer were as one. The first American music appreciation books were guides to help hesitant beginners to figure out concert music on their democratizing path to social integration. Then the academics got hold of it to produce a fresh scholastic market. In Britain, it went the other way around. The first British book of the movement was written by a professor at the Royal Academy of Music. Stuart Macpherson's Music and Its Appreciation came out in 1907. There were three key issues that propelled this British movement into being: class, nationalism, and formalism. The first of these concerned the simple economics of concerts. It was during the 1890s that the elite of British cities turned away from the public exhibitionism of the grand concert. They hosted instead exclusive recitals in their private homes. This upper-crust trend of showing off your property was to culminate in the interwar sensation of the private opera house at Glyndebourne. But this relocation of patronage left a huge economic hole in the free market fortunes of the public concerts. The solution was to corral the new suburban audiences and other aspirant workers. They'd been lured back into city centres by public transport and streets made safe by electric light to enjoy the new genre of the musical comedy. And for classical music to take them on, it needed a mass audience to narrow the monetary gap between the upper gallery and the dress stalls. London's Queen's Hall, for instance, was opened by entrepreneur Robert Newman in 1893, and he immediately felt the pressure to find new audiences to fill his 3,000 seats. Hence, Robert Newman's promenade concerts, where you could walk and smoke, which became Henry Wood's promenade concerts, and eventually the BBC proms, smoking not permitted since the 70s. The Music Appreciation Movement's part in all of this was to promote concert going as a worthy occupation. The listener had a job to do as imperative to the success of the concert as the musician on stage and the composer's score. Leisure was converted into labour. Secondly, there was Britain's scrawny cultural status. The Russian pianist Anton Rubinstein made this clear in his autobiography of 1882. He wrote, "I speak frankly, but without malice. Of the German people, at least 50% understand music. Of the French, no more than 16%. While among the English, the least musical of peoples, not more than 2% can be found with any knowledge of music. Even the Americans have a higher appreciation of music than the English." The early music appreciation writers tended to agree with this, but as a historical condition. They accused immigrants in the 18th and early 19th centuries of taking over the musical culture, a musical dark age, they called it. Later writers blamed a regressive Church of England for bathing British music in the blood of the Lamb, obsessed as it was with worthy oratorios and liturgical dreariness. The third issue was the need to elevate music as an intellectual act. The problems around that had certainly been driven by foreign influence. During the 19th century, German music and German thought about music applied a supreme influence on the British scene. Several British composers trained in Leipzig or Berlin. Among them were Ethel Smythe and Vaughan Williams. And the roots of the appreciation movement can be found in German tracts, such as Eduard Hanslick's The Beautiful in Music. In this, he upheld the romantic principle that instrumental music is the purest, because it refers to nothing but itself. Hanslick despised the idea that music represented feelings. He pointed out that a forest is cool and shady, but it doesn't represent the feelings of coolness and shadiness. His influence was profound, and it set at the heart of much of the music appreciation agenda, which insisted on the autonomy of music and the need to explain how this is so. Trouble is, they took on this formalism at a time when Richard Strauss was showing just how materialistic music could be. Strauss proudly pointed out that, for the first time in a symphonic score, his cowbells represented cows. But the movement stood firmly against the materialistic for other reasons. In order to strengthen the link between the composer and the listener, it had to downgrade the materiality of the performer who sat or stood between the two. To write off performance wasn't easy, and a rupture took place because of the attempt. But in the early days, activists had set their sights on piano teachers and their like because they claimed the music these people taught was worthless, while the pianist's efforts concerned technique, not insight. A leading light in the early American movement was Thomas Whitney Surrett, who drew a vision of a little girl seated before a ponderous mass of iron, steel, wood, wires and hammers, which we call a pianoforte, her legs dangling uncomfortably in space, her little fingers trying painfully to find the right key and at the same time to keep in correct position, struggling hard the while to relate together two strange things, a curious black dot on a page and an ivory key 2 feet below it, for neither of which she feels much affection. And of course, it would have to be a little girl. Stuart McPherson wrote that the pernicious idea had grown up that musical art was merely a feminine concern, and thus the average man came to think of art as effeminate. This prejudice was rendered all the more acute right at the movement's birth. Music's autonomy had been championed by the art for art's sake aesthetic movement. It was its philosopher, Walter Pater, who stated that all art constantly aspires to the condition of music. Oscar Wilde added sentimentally that music is the art which is most nigh to tears and memory. The British music scene thrived on this fabulous attention. but this rapport was ripped apart in 1895 by Oscar Wilde's trials and conviction for gross indecency. From that moment on, the music appreciation movement stressed the virility of music. Time and time again, you find in its manuals phrases such as this, that music ennobles man, it makes for joy and invigoration and the heightening of vitality. The movement's pioneers were equally disturbed by the growth of natural science. A materialist affair, if ever there was one, wrote the principal of the Royal Academy of Music. The two great evolutionists, Charles Darwin and his rival Herbert Spencer, both wrote about music, but with opposite views. Luckily, the movement was able to exploit support from them both. Darwin wrote that music has a wonderful power of recalling in a vague and indefinite manner those strong emotions which were felt when our early progenitors courted each other by the aid of vocal tones. Well, vague and indefinite is perfect appreciation talk. It underlines the autonomy of music. Meanwhile, Herbert Spencer believed that speech came first and that emotional vocalizing led to music. He wrote an essay in 1890, a little after Darwin's death, that brought their dispute back to public attention. Spencer ended with an impeccable appreciation claim. Music must rank as the highest of the fine arts, as the one which, more than any other, ministers to human welfare. At the time, composer Hubert Parry had written a proto-music appreciation tract titled The Art of Music. When the next edition came out, he cashed in by changing it to The Evolution of the Art of Music. The British pioneer of the self-help wing of the movement, the one who most truly promoted good music to good people, as he put it, was Percy Scholes. Scholes was born in Leeds in 1877. He was a lifelong socialist who asked that his epitaph should be, "The common people heard him gladly." He was mainly self-taught in the subject. He started out as a music lecturer for the Cooperative Holidays Association, a sort of rambling club for working men. It had close links to the YMCA and also the National Home Reading Union, which was a mutual aid outfit designed to teach workers to read civilising books. He soon formed the Home Music Study Union on similar practical lines. In World War I, Scholes developed music courses for troops through the YMCA. He organised the sending of 10,000 mouth organs to the trenches, which struck many as the best place for them. In his classes, he'd started to use gramophone records. He said that records did for music what the printing press had done for literature. Funnily enough, he went on to champion the cause of the player piano. But ultimately, he's remembered most for what is still the most celebrated single product of British music appreciation, the 1,140 pages of the Oxford Companion to Music. He wrote all of the entries, bar one. At their best, they are simple, clear and vivid. At their worst, they deride all music but classical. Ragtime is branded as crazy rhythms, where dancers are deafened by grotesque noises. Well, music appreciation came out of the sole need to campaign for classical music, and if it could urinate on its rivals, it did. In his time, Scholes was most generally known for his presence on the radio. In 1922, the Commercial British Broadcasting Company employed him as their first guide to music programmes. Scholes's role was to bring music appreciation skills into the studio. His first talk was titled, How to Enjoy Music. Scholes later wrote that, I possess only one claim to uniqueness, and I cling to it. I happen to be the man who, during the first 5 years of broadcasting, got more hundreds of letters than anybody else from people who objected to classical music, or who were just beginning to see something in it, or who had lately found themselves swinging over into keen enjoyment of it. The big thing we still have to do is to encourage them to listen, actively to listen, not merely to sit and hear. Scholes believed that the common listener came across blocks to musicianship, and there were four blocks: texture, form, colour and style. It was the job of the tutor to demystify these blocks in order to develop musical listening. But the more academic members of the movement were critical of the popularising vocabulary of Scholes. He defended himself, arguing that Our business is not so much to train them to appreciation as to awaken their interest and so supply the incentive that will lead them gradually to train themselves. There was one method of doing this that Scholes brought into the BBC, and it's still there. As he put it, for a long period, the BBC fought savagely against my suggestion that programmes should be introduced by a short description of the chief work. Now, in 1932, it has just announced a generous capitulation, and its patrons will be the gainers. Next time you hear Petrock Trelawney present a concert, spare a thought for Percy Scholes.
I'm sure Petrock does. You can hear the next essay in Richard Witz's series on the music appreciation movement at the same time tomorrow night on Radio 3. The producer in Bristol is Sarah Davis. And there's plenty more musical appreciation to come at the proms.
From the BBC Proms on Radio 3 comes a bicentenary celebration of a master pianist. Franz Liszt's piano music is brought to life in a late-night proms recital from Marc-André Amelin. Just over an hour of bewitching virtuosity and a programme that traverses the entire range of Liszt's entrancing musical world. Wednesday night, 10 o'clock, BBC Radio 3.
Yes, this is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and also online. The time now is 11 o'clock and we turn our attention to jazz. It's time for this week's edition of Jazz on 3. Here's Jez Nelson.
Hello. Tonight, the Jazz on 3 repeat season concludes with a pair of standout gigs from one of the most consistently interesting jazz festivals in the UK, Cheltenham, with a highlight from 2010 and from this year. Groove that surely proves he's worthy of his title of Professor of Rhythmic Music. Bandleader, composer and educator Django Bates provides tonight's first set. And while Professor Bates undoubtedly influences many younger musicians, he also takes his own inspiration from the latest generation of jazz players. Tonight's Cheltenham Commission is performed by a pick of the finest young UK talent around. By way of contrast, in the second half of today's programme, we've a 70-minute soundscape, at times serene, at others menacing, courtesy of Food. That's British saxophonist Ian Bellamy and Norwegian percussionist Thomas Strønen live at Cheltenham in 2010 with their special guest guitarist Christian Finez. Well, I have to say I've spent many happy weekends in Cheltenham over the last 10 years or so. Each May, the Gloucestershire spa town opens the doors of its fine buildings to jazz musicians and jazz fans from all over the world. As well as the international stars, there's always a good crop of UK players in town, and that was the inspiration behind tonight's first concert. Why not make use of the fact that all these great musicians are in the same place at the same time and write a piece for them? Well, this year, BBC Radio 3 and Jazz on 3 commissioned Django Bates to do just that. Having seen the trio Troika playing at a Jazz on 3 show last year, Django decided he wanted to put that group at the heart of a large band he'd put together to play brand new music at Cheltenham. To that lineup of keyboard player Kit Downs, guitarist Chris Montague, and Joshua Blackmore on drums, he added the leader of the brilliant Phronesis, bass player Jasper Hoiby, and booked Shabaka Hutchins, Jay Phelps, Dennis Baptiste, and James Allsop as his front line. Not bad, eh? He named the band the TDEs after the inspirational artistic director of the Cheltenham Festival, Tony Dudley Evans, and set about writing some fiendishly complex music to challenge his new octet. Well, after a week of rehearsals here in the Jazz on 3 studios, they emerged ready to roar, and you're about to hear how they thrilled the Saturday night audience packed into the Pillar Room in Cheltenham. Here they are, playing music commissioned for Radio 3, the TDEs.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You heard Shebaka Hutchins and Dennis Baptiste soloing. So this next piece is called Active Irresponsibility, and it goes into another piece which I'll tell you the name of when we've played it. So here we go, Active Irresponsibility.
We'll be right back.